Good morning, this is Dr. Dan Guerra, coming to you from Authentic Biochemistry Podcast Studios in the Inland Pacific Northwest. Today is the first day of summer, the 21st of June, 2022. This is lecture number 5 in membrane biochemistry, and we've been talking about action potentials and neurotransmission, particularly about plasticity at synapses. And of course, this is a membrane-associated phenomenon. So we're going to get into a little bit more detail about this. Again, this is a neuroscience-flavored lecture. Right? We covered a couple papers last time, and we're going to finish one of them today, maybe introduce a little bit more information on some other publications. I don't know if I'll have time to do that. So that's my promise to you. That's where we're going to go. So remember that I was talking about intrinsic membrane excitability. And what that is the ability of a neuron basically just to generate an action potential. But that action potential is a product of a specific signal coming from a given input. That means that the strength of the signal and the cooperation of the membrane proteins at the synapse to generate an action potential downstream from the axon to the adjacent neuron is going to be a product of the strength of the signal as well as the metabolomics and the electrogenic capacity of the membrane. Okay? And we call that the intrinsic membrane excitability. So it has to do with the hardware of that membrane. So you have both passive and active membrane properties. I told you last time the passive properties include capacitance, resistance. These are basic electrochemical signatures. And of course, the resting membrane potential based on the potassium gradient primarily, and then the sodium counterbalance. And of course, that's how we normally talk about membrane potentials. But remember that this is about biochemistry of membranes. So membrane morphology will dictate the amount and the selectivity of the specific ion channels in the plasma membrane so that some are open at rest. When they're open at rest, we call those leak channels, because they're dissipating the electrochemical potential of the membrane, you see. So the active properties of the neuronal membrane, of course, are going to be determined overall by how many channels are found in a given three-dimensional space at a given time. So that includes their spatial distribution, their temporal distribution, and of course, the specific activity of voltage-gated and calcium-activated ion currency. And I told you that membrane-related changes in that excitability, the intrinsic excitability, is termed intrinsic plasticity. And it predominantly occurs through the alterations in active neuronal membrane properties, where those intrinsic phenomena occur in response to stimuli within the hippocampus and the neocortex. So intrinsic plasticity can contribute to learning-related processes because of this plasticity. And it's a form of what they call homeoplastic or homeostatic plasticity. And that occurs in response to chronic as well as tonic changes in neuronal activity. Chronic and tonic. So intrinsic plasticity modulates the acquisition. Now, this is the readout in terms of psychology and reasoning. Intrinsic plasticity may be the neural correlation to the acquisition of new memories. So another name for that is metaplasticity. Although intrinsic plasticity is transcriptionally mediated, for sure, because you have to get the transcription and translation of the polypeptides in the membrane according to the requirement of the metabolomics and the electrogenic signatures. There's also a very powerful epigenetic mechanism involved there. And that's usually working at the network level. Now, epigenetic networks make sense because these are immediate responses. So because every event that occurs is a novel event. Okay, so there aren't cycles. There are pseudo-cycles in nature. To have a cycle means that you come back exactly where you were at the beginning and that you just repeat the cycle. Now you can change maybe the speed of moving through it, or there are other nuances of downstream and upstream modification. But that would be a real cycle. But there are no real cycles because time is always elapsing. The delta T in the denominator, correct? Correct. Answer my own questions there when I don't have a lecture hall in front of me. So that delta T, the change in time, means everything. So it's not a substance ontology. It is an event ontology. I keep saying that. Again, think of Whitehead's philosophy, particularly his discussion of epistemology. Now, I want you to keep that in mind when we go into the details here. Given the role of DNA methylation that I've already described to you for learning and for memory induction and then incorporation of the memory into the neural circuitry, the extent of the modulatory methylation, which is an immediate epigenetic phenomenon based on a novel event, and all events are novel because no events are cyclic, as I just said. What the regulation is at the level of is an adaptation, back again to the neural correlation, an adaptation of both synaptic strength and the extent of membrane excitability. So you have to have a metabolic control over those events, and that's going to require a bioenergetic component. Okay. So in parallel to a regulatory contribution to the synaptic plasticity and to homeostatic synaptic scaling, remember that's a hierarchical shifting of basically currency so that the signal becomes more profound, more written deeply, and therefore the memory is laid in more deeply, right? You understand how that works? Go back to the Hibbian postulate, right? Neurons that fire together, wire together. The more often that they are fired at the same time or co-occurring, the more likely that they are going to be rewired together. And again, this is like a wiring diagram. Obviously, it's a metaphor, okay? But this is really significant because you have this homeostatic synaptic scaling, which is a mechanism. Then you have the DNA methylation, which is the novel event. And obviously that's going to modulate any flow of current information, experiential information, throughout an already elaborated memory network. And the fine-tuning of that goes back to that intrinsic membrane excitability. So that means the platform where the proteins are, the voltage-gated channels, the calcium channels, the membrane organization in terms of bilayer, in terms of hex two phase, and then the nano concentrating of specific voltage-gated channels in regions of the membrane, all of that's going to play a role in that intrinsic membrane excitability. Right? That's the point I'm trying to make. And that's based on membrane lipid raft transfer of the proteins coming from the transcription and the translation, usually through that in the endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi apparatus, the plasma membrane, of the polypeptides that make up those channels. And then, of course, all the co-adapter molecules, and then all the enzymes and receptors, like the G-protein coupled receptors that are in the membrane adjacent and associated with those voltage-gated channels, right? So that's all going to be an event that's going to be intrinsic, the IME, membrane excitability. But then the novel alteration of that based on the novelty of the experience, And every experience is novel. Even though there are patterns of recognition and similarities, every new event will be a new event. The brain may try to acquire the event according to a pattern and sequester those electrochemical and metabolomic events as a pattern using the given signatures of the intrinsic membrane excitability. But because we have an epigenetic phenomenon occurring, and then the membrane biophysical dynamics, what they call topodynamics, right, of the membrane, you have real-time alteration of the concentrating effect of those voltage-gated channels. And therefore, that's what affects the enhancement of the firing-wiring correlation. See, that's why some memories are very deeply set and some memories are easily forgotten because of the electrochemical correlation there, but also what is the biochemistry? The biochemistry is gene expression and then protein synthesis and protein glycosylation and protein prenylation and acylation, phosphorylation, succinylation, all based on immediate changes starting all the way back at the chromatin retailoring, both of the nuclear genome and the mitochondrial genome, because you need the mitochondrial genome having an epigenetic signature because you have to upgrade the bioenergetic phenomenon because you need a lot of ATP to run an action potential. See? So it's not something that's happening in a vacuum. I hate using that word vacuum since I'm talking about gas laws, right? But it's not something that's happening alone. Remember that everything in biochemistry, everything in life, everything in living systems that can be described at the biochemical level, right? And so you have biochemical level, and then you have biophysiological, you have the physiological response level. And then the genetic and epigenetic components are creating that phenomenon at the protein level, but also, of course, at the rearrangement of all of the molecular structures that much come to be attuned to the new event. And again, every event that is taken on as a sense input because of electrochemical radiation bombarding all of those sensory neurons constantly from the moment of conception to the moment of death, yes, even during sleep phenomena, there are certain sensoria that are open. And the brain is doing other things to compartmentalize, sequester, and concentrate events during the waking moments. And that's also based on light signatures and probably carbon dioxide and oxygen signatures, just to name a few abiotic events. Right? But think of all the biochemistry involved in day-night cycles that we talked about, the suprachiasmic nucleus and all that hypophysis and all of the endocrine hormone regulation that leads with clock genes and yields an alteration of the proximal and the distal reasoning capabilities of the central nervous system, that final readout that becomes the self, right, in the human organism. All of that is related, but then superposed on the entire network is the real causality, which is the exercise of the will, which chooses this and not that, which chooses to remember and not remember, which chooses to forget because it's too painful or because it wasn't emotionally tied to something that was linked to a component of the reasoning that was considered essential to carry on with the development of self through life. Right? So I know it sounds a lot of philosophical signatures I'm throwing in this lecture. I'm doing it purposely because to understand biochemistry, you need to understand epistemology and metaphysics. You need to be incorporating those skill sets from philosophy. Otherwise, you're working again in a sterile world. And there's nothing sterile about life, right? The difference between living and non-living, the difference between the human walking down along by the river and the rocks he's walking around, can't be any further than the largest scalar event that occurs when you're thinking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions light years away, where there may be some other galaxy. Because the living system is so dynamically event-oriented. It is an autonomous system that is regenerating itself, yes, by things like mitosis and gametogenesis, if it carries out sexual reproduction. But also the whole event ontology that creates in the most sophisticated of all the animals, the human, the ability for the central nervous system to function as an adaptive organ to deal with the environmental changes that become what are relative to the human experience. And these include things like memory and long-term potentiation, the kind of things we're talking about, which are, again, we can find neural correlates. Just because we find neural correlates doesn't mean this is all pre-programmed. And the epigenetic phenomenon proves the point of a lack of programmability. You have this intrinsic, for example, membrane excitability, which even in itself is a constantly changing event ontology because of membrane fluid dynamics, let alone membrane topodynamics, right? The alteration of membrane morphology just because of the incorporation of different sphingolipids or ceramide, sphingomyelin versus ceramide, because of the activity of neutral sphingomyelinase within in situ, within the membrane. Altering, yes, the chemistry, but also the physics, and thus the physiology, and then the temporal signatures of that physiology, of just that membrane, and just that part of the membrane that's going through that excitation. See? All right. So in parallel to the regulatory contribution to synaptic plasticity and this homeostatic synaptic scaling, this DNA methylation, which is the real-time event ontology, probably modulates that flow of information throughout the memory-related networks, right? And it goes through a process of interacting with intrinsic membrane excitability of individual neurons, even though they occur in a cluster, right? In a nucleus, we could call it. Understand that each neuron has its own molecular signature, all right? So the idea of that 2016 paper we were talking about, the first, you know, the paper we've been spending a lot of time on, which we're still evaluating here, was trying to determine how DNA methyltransferase activity was involved in, again, now we're going very, very basic again, very just straightforward biochemistry physiology. How did the methyltransferase activity help regulate the intrinsic membrane excitability of very specific neurons, the cortical pyramidal neurons? Now, a reminder about methylation mechanisms. Once again, you have 5-methylcytosine and 6-methyladenosine. And that sixth atom on adenosine is a nitrogen atom. And in the cytosine, it's a carbon atom. That makes a difference too in terms of the ability for that methyl group to alter the electronic orbitals around those atomic structures, which has a lot to do with the fine-tuning of the excitability of the intrinsic membrane excitability profile. Okay. There's a lot of unique enzymology there too, as you know. All right. So remember too that 5-methylcytosine methylation, that 5-MC can be oxidized. It can be oxidized, for example, simply to the first oxidation product, which is the 5-hydroxymethylcytosine. And that process is carried out by the enzymes called the TET enzymes. There's 3 of those. And that TET stands for 10-11 translocation, which I told you with the heritages of that name. So pathways of cytosine demethylation again, are mediated by this 10-11 translocation. And so what you get is a cytosine residue. You get a methyl transfer to that fifth carbon. Then if you're going to go through this oxidation with the TET enzyme, first product is going to be 5-hydroxymethylcytosine. Then that particular product can go through the adenosine deaminase reaction. That's right, adenosine deaminase. And the product of that is going to be 5-hydroxymethylcytosine. But also, the deaminase is going to give you 5-hydroxymethyluracil. So you go from 5-hydroxymethylcytosine, and then after the AID reaction, as adenosine deaminase, you're going to make the 5-hydroxymethyluracil. And then the next reaction for the complete utilization of this now altered epigenetic signature product is going to be your classic DNA repair mechanism catalyzed by thymine DNA glycosylase. Thymine deglycosylase then will enter you into base excision repair, which can bring you back to a cytosine residue. So that's taking cytosine, going through the methylation pattern, and then resynthesizing cytosine after 4 enzymatic reactions. But remember that 5-hydroxymethylcytosine can also be converted to 5-formyl cytosine, and in fact, also ultimately to 5-carboxy cytosine, complete oxidation to carboxylic acid. So you have hydroxy, formyl, and carboxy. All three of those can be ultimately run to the base excision repair process, resynthesizing cytosine. I'm telling you all this because that's the kind of detail you need to understand with epigenetic modification. It's not a straightforward methylate, demethylate, right? That's what you normally get when you're listening to a regular biochemistry lecture about epigenetic alterations. This is not a regular biochemistry lecture. This is authentic biochemistry. And you're listening to a biochemistry professor of over 30 years, right? And this isn't a brag, it's a fact. And the reason I'm giving you this fact again and again is so that the audience that I'm trying to build here is for you to get the real details of what's going on biochemically in living systems, as understood by a biochemist, right? Okay. So that's why I'm going through all this process to you. Now, I also told you many times that DNA methyltransferases can act in reverse. They can also reverse the reaction and therefore demethylate, okay? So you can reverse the reaction, depend on substrate product kinetics. 6-methyladenosine methylation, which is generated by enzymes like N6AMT1 and the ALK-BH1. But the level of 6-methyladenosine in cells, okay, is much more stable because those two methylation reactions cannot carry out demethylation. And that is because of the fact that you have methylated a nitrogen atom and not a carbon atom in a ring structure. And because of that, you're altering the stereochemistry and the electronic configuration. And because of the hybridization of those electrons around the orbitals that are generating that methyl modification, much more stable product. Now, promoters and enhancers are typical sites for DNA methylation. And we talked about this. And that's indeed where you're going to find in the nucleus methyl, for example, methyl CpG binding proteins. These are the MBDs. Remember, we called those domains another name before. We called them bromodomains. So bromodomains are readers, but they're also known as CpG binding proteins or methyl binding proteins or MBDs. So you talk about bromodomains, you can talk about methyl binding domains within polypeptides. And remember too that excessive inhibition of the methyltransferase by using those two methyltransferase inhibitors I told you about last time, which are basically derivatives of nucleophiles, those two inhibitors can actually induce hypermethylation at unique CpG sites and not rare ones. We said over 600 of them were found when you get the reversive activity of inhibiting methyltransferase and get enhanced metastatic cancer from it when those inhibitors were actually being used to what? To be as cancer drug agents to diminish metastasis. Now think about it for a second. Here's another thing, a deep insight, I hope. Why would methylation, because if you're inhibiting methylation and therefore you're getting a benefit, a drug that's going to be an anti-cancer drug, right? A DNA methyltransferase inhibitor is an anti-cancer drug. Why would it be utilized as one? Because we're getting a lot of methyl transfer to, for example, cytosine residues, CpG islands, and promoter regions of genes involved in some kind of oncogenic event. Why would that make it so that you wouldn't get a metastatic event? Think about it. If you have excessive amount of methylation, what won't occur? You won't get terminal differentiation. You won't get much gene expression at all. Without terminal differentiation or overall nascent gene expression to deal with the alteration of the chemistry of in the nucleus associated with oncogenesis, you won't be able to generate an apoptotic event, thus killing the cancer cell. Right? So getting that kind of methylation pattern, right? You would normally think that might stop all gene expression, that might stop an oncogenic event. Not at all. Too much methylation can promote carcinogenesis. You understand how that works now? Okay. But I didn't make that explicit before. I was thinking about it when I was telling you that in the lecture, but now you understand it, right? So when I'm telling you, you get this hypermethylation via the inhibition of the DNA methyltransferase in that pharmacology paper, you're then enhancing the metastatic capacity of a tumor. Okay. So the 2016 murine paper, what did it tell us? Okay, that was the paper that we were covering a great deal. And I don't want much time here to tell you because I'm going to have to do another lecture because I can see I've got about a minute left. It offered evidence that the epigenetic mechanisms of methylation, demethylation alone could account for the unique pattern of gene expression necessary to be formed as a neural correlate to account for at least some of the neurophysiology that's linked to the creation and stabilization of long-term memory, which can result from behavioral training, and that neoepigenetic alterations like novel and nascent cytosine methylation appear to correlate with synaptic plasticity and postsynaptic strength, including long-term potentiation and long-term depression, plus the synaptic scaling, which was intrinsic, and postsynaptic strength, which is the product. Now, next time I'm going to detail of some of that neurochemical signature definition. Okay. I promised you I would do that. So I'm going to stop here because to do that requires a great deal, at least 20 minutes of discussion, explaining what those terms mean and how they correlate to the larger scale of what we're talking about in terms of memory. So I'm going to end here, 21st of June, 2022. This is Dr. Dan Guerra from Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Wishing you a very pleasant day, first day of summer, and bye for now.